Welcome to the Five C's podcast. I'm your host, Charlene Norman, and this is where we discuss all things clarity and collaboration for the community of climate change makers. This is the fifth and final episode of Shell Shocked, Moral Injury and the Leaders Carrying It. And before we go anywhere, I want to take a minute or two to tell you how we got here. Because this series didn't start with a plan, it started with a feeling that I couldn't name. I've spent 4 years on this podcast talking to some of the most thoughtful people working at the intersection of business, climate, and human behavior. And somewhere in year three, I noticed something. The guests weren't just describing problems in the world, they were describing something happening inside the people trying to solve those problems. An exhaustion that wasn't burnout, a self-doubt that didn't match the evidence of people's actual capabilities, a fracture in the ability to trust in institutions and systems, and in many cases, themselves. And I didn't have words for it until I found Dr. Deborah Boris. Let me tell you about Deborah. She earned her PhD at UCLA and has maintained a private practice in clinical psychology in the Los Angeles area for over 35 years. Her background includes specialized training in trauma, disaster response, health psychology, stress management, and ethics. From 2022 to 2024, she completed additional training in eco-psychology, the interface of psychology and the environment. She is co-founder and co-chair of the Los Angeles County Psychological Association's Eco-Psychology Special Interest Group, which educates psychologists about climate change and how to work with people experiencing climate distress. She's also an active member of the Climate Psychology Alliance of North America. Deborah is a trained climate cafe leader and co-developer of a structured group program called From Moral Injury to Moral Alignment. It was developed with her collaborator, Nikita Palmisani. That program has been the heart of our entire series, and all of Deborah's details are in the show notes. Now back to my setup for this finale of the series. In episode one, I recorded a solo piece to set the stage. I introduced a distinction that I think changes everything about how we understand what leaders are carrying right now. Moral injustice is what happens to you, the event. The moment you discover that the institution you trusted, the values you were told an organization held, the rules of the game you built your career around, well, they were not what they claimed to be. Moral injury is what that leaves behind. The fracture in your sense of right and wrong. The exhaustion you can't quite explain. The voice at 2 o'clock in the morning that says, "What if I'm wrong again?" I walk through 5 ways that moral injustice shows up for leaders specifically. The bait and switch, coercion, personal transgression, witnessing, and the shattered worldview, the one I think most of us in this space carry longest without ever naming it. In episode 2, Deborah joined the conversation and she drew the line between burnout and moral injury. Two things that share symptoms but have completely different sources and completely different remedies. She walked us through the research going back to Vietnam veterans, the DOJ department chair who watched a colleague's lifetime of scientific data get deleted and couldn't say a word about it, and what happens in the body when leaders are trained to push everything down, soldier forward. Most importantly, she described what happens when people finally hear the term moral injury applied to their own experience. Relief. Recognition. The exhale of finally having a name for something they thought was a personal failing. In episode 3, we got practical. Deborah walked us through the program she developed with her colleague Nikita Palmisani, From Moral Injury to Moral Alignment. The unpacking, the values identification, the move toward action that is genuinely yours. She introduced us to Finnish researcher Panu Pikkala's 3-part coping framework, emotional expression, restorative time out, and values-based action. And she shared why all 3 have to be present for any one of them to work. And she told us what she does personally to stay viable while working inside all of this. That last part, I think, was the most generous thing she shared all series. In episode 4, we got into organizations. The warning signs most leaders miss, the slow dimming of people who were once on fire for the work, mislabeled as performance problems when they're actually symptoms of something with a different remedy. Stress inoculation, 2 hours at the start of any change initiative that most organizations never spend, and what that costs downstream. And we ended with the long game question. What actually changes when someone does the inner work and walks back into the same system? Deborah's answer was honest, was not a guarantee, but it was very real. And now we're here at episode 5, the hardest conversation of this series, the one I've been building toward, about collapse awareness, about what it means to look at the evidence clearly, without flinching, without denial, and still choose to keep going, about why grief and joy are not opposites, about what the path forward actually asks of us as human beings, not just as leaders. Dr. Deborah is with me one final time, and I want to say before we begin, this series would not exist without her generosity, her clinical precision, and her willingness to bring her full self into every conversation. I want you to bring a framework into the conversation that helped me make sense of where we actually are. Jem Mandel is a sustainability professor in the UK who has spent decades thinking about collapse awareness, not doom, not denial, but honest engagement with what the science is actually saying about our future. And he developed something called the Deep Adaptation Framework, including 6 questions he calls the 6 R's. Dr. Deborah, can you walk us through those?
He started realizing, I think it's now something like 20 years ago, that the way sustainability was being focused on then was really an illusion. And he started realizing that the science was telling us there's going to be some degree of collapse, that the world and world governments are just not doing the things that, and they have to be really intense, dramatic things that are not being done to slow this down enough to prevent some level of catastrophe. So he wrote books about that, developed a framework of collapse awareness. How do we deal with this uncertainty? What's necessary as humans for dealing with the unknown of how far collapse and catastrophe is going to happen? Over time, he, with like-minded individuals, developed the Deep Adaptation Framework in terms of what questions should we be asking each other towards skills, qualities, and ways of coping with the very uncertain future that will involve some degree of collapse. So he came up with the 6 R's at this point. Started with around 3 R's, it's expanded. So first is resilience. To do deep reflection on and journaling, so forth, what do we value most that we would want to keep or hold on to, if possible, regardless of some degree of collapse? Relinquishment. What do we need to let go of for coping as effectively as we can with collapse and changes in society and culture? 3, restoration. What could we try to bring back, even if it's in another form, in the process of or as we go through some type of environmental and other collapses? And what could we bring back that we may already have lost at this point? And that, by the way, could even include things like indigenous or native practices that we learn about that seem very valuable that have been shunted aside. Number four, reconciliation. With whom can we make peace who has been alienated as an individual or a group? Number five, reclamation. What can we take back from dominant systems that have taken over valuable resources, human inheritance, human history? We may think about AI and how so much of the human corpus of knowledge is now being taken by and used by AI. Six, regeneration. What or whom can we now nurture newly out of our love of life?
Those are very powerful questions. They're certainly not anything I don't think that anyone can answer quickly on.
Oh, absolutely. They're for ongoing reflection, journaling, examination, just kind of maintaining an openness to the questions, kind of Rainer Maria Rilke. You've got to love the questions themselves, and you will, if you live the questions, you will ultimately live your way into the answers.
The overwhelming thing I take away from those six questions is this: relationships matter, things don't. That is the fundamental thing about being human, isn't it? And if we could even come close to remembering that one small thing, I think we'd make a leap forward none of us can quite measure yet.
I'm totally with you. I mean, unfortunately, this late stage capitalism is all about extraction, commodifying everything.
I think the best thing about living right now is we can see what's wrong. We can see the bits of what we've gotten wrong, and the hard part is figuring out how to move forward. But I think the best part, genuinely, is seeing what happens when the pendulum swings too far, because that means it can swing back.
Yes, I think of that famous MLK quote, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. I really believe that. Unfortunately, there are losses involved every time in that. I mean, sometimes like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people can suffer or die as it's slowly bending.
Deborah, I want to end this series with a hard conversation. I came to a conclusion a few years ago, and it was not a comfortable one. There may be no version of this where humans can fully course correct in time. I had to figure out what that meant for why I keep going. Have you sat at that table?
Yes. I'm in the course of going back for the training I did in eco-psychology, you know, in the 2020 through 23 period. I never disbelieved that the climate crisis was happening, especially as wildfires got worse and worse in my Los Angeles hillside area. But I had to reckon with just how bad it was. And as I was learning partly science, partly mental health in the eco-psychology training, you know, I learned of how many of the serious ecological thresholds scientists have pointed out we've already passed, and how it's, you know, there's some degree of environmental collapse that we're already in the process of, and that happens congruent with and partly has the same sources as some degree of social and political collapse. So that, you know, the eco poetry I started writing at that time was part of my grieving process and is very imbued with that. So yes, definitely still reckoning with it, have done a certain amount in that regard. And I will say, in terms of the hopeful part that you already raised, one of the things I found, and that many people who take that plunge into the reckoning and grieving of the decline of our environment, climate, and so forth, fine, is that the more you open up to and start doing the painful work of the grieving and reckoning, so that's like the more you open up and lower your defenses, so to speak, on that vulnerable, painful side, it actually opens up further room for joy and even appreciation of nature as it is, but now all kinds of joy. And that it makes psychological sense to me as a clinical psychologist that when our defenses, you know, when our barriers are tough about one thing and rigid about one thing, it's not selective. It tends to make us numb about a variety of things. Well, the converse, happily, is also true. When you do necessary grieving, reckoning, you know, dealing with the range of emotions like anger, powerlessness, fear, as well as grief, on that painful end, it does your defenses had to lower generally, so it opens up more space for joy. So that's one of the positives.
When you say it opens up more space for joy, how do you feel that space? If you're feeling down, if you're feeling pretty bad, how does joy actually get in?
So part of it is in doing poetry, journaling, talking with like-minded people about the grief. So meaning in doing some of the grief, which you have to actually do that painful work, I automatically, somewhat to my surprise, but then it made sense, started noticing, wow, I'm actually feeling more positive things when I'm out in nature. Now that I've been doing some of that grief work, I actually just feel all of my emotions in like as if things are more colorful, so to speak. So some of it was spontaneous and some of it was being drawn more to emotional connectedness, feeling freer to express emotions, both about nature, even more so with people. So I guess you can do things, I suppose, to consciously facilitate it. It wasn't so much so with me, although I did start putting myself, even back then, a couple things. I became more open to opportunities, spontaneously more open opportunities. So, for example, in our organization, among many interest committees, there's an expressive arts committee. So when I heard about it, I thought, oh, I'm going to check that out. And so I started attending their meetings, and they would always have an art activity and interesting art or creative activities. And then we had this amazing retreat of the committee members, you know, up in a corner of the state of Washington that was just wonderful. We did all sorts of arts and movement activities. So I became more aware of and drawn to activities that were more experiential and brought me joy, but also just was more and am more in touch with my feelings of all sorts now. And it includes recognizing, but more able to tolerate recognizing painful feelings, as well as recognizing and being more aware of and feeling more of happy, joyful feelings.
You know, you've just articulated something I've noticed about myself this past year. I am not an artist, but music has become different for me. I actually focus on individual notes now. I get lost in them. And the baby rabbits destroying my garden, I used to be annoyed. Now I watch them and I think, well, whoever or whatever created us created those creatures too, with just as much joy in them as we have in us. Things I've walked past for 20 years, I'm seeing them as if for the first time. It's an insatiable curiosity I've always had, and it has gone into overdrive. You've just told me why. Thank you.
Oh, sure. And your example of noticing things outside is perfect. I had an individual client who had just gone through a major life transition that was not a bad one. It was something she chose, but she was feeling really disconcerted about being temporarily in a new foreign physical environment that she had to stay in for a bit. And so I had her do an activity. It happened to be she was right at a shoreline where she'd go out on the patio, and I gave her a set of questions that she pulled up on her phone, where she would isolate one sensory modality at a time. Part of it involved closing her eyes to when she was focusing on sounds. And so she would focus on one sensory modality at a time in terms of what do you hear, all the things you hear right now for a couple of minutes. And she'd close her eyes and notice all she heard and just label, oh, there's an airplane. Oh, there's the sound of the water hitting the sand. And then she'd shift, you know, after a couple of minutes to the next sense. And it was so centering for her. And what she said she noticed is in the next few days, she appreciated so much more of the environment she was in and noticed beauty in it from that sensory focusing activity, as well as it being calming. So she got two benefits, the joy of noticing the colors and the sounds, and she noticed unique things like, oh, when the water's hitting the sand, there's different rhythms to it, but there's also this pattern and these birds. Wow, I can now pick out individual bird sounds that are and how different they are. So the joy as well as the calming was a revelation to her.
Clear-eyed, not hopeless. That's where I want to leave you. Not with a promise that it's all going to be fine. Not with a denial of how serious this is, but with the honest position that grief and joy are not opposites, that reckoning with what is hard opens you up to what is beautiful, to what is possible, and to the relationships that actually matter. Dr. Deborah, thank you for your time, your honesty, your clinical precision, and your genuine humanity throughout this series. Again, Deborah's contact details and the program she runs are in the show notes. If anything in this series landed for you, please reach out to her. You and I are living with the unintended consequences of actions we have taken over the last, gosh, at least 100 years. I believe if we knew then what we know now, we'd all be asking for a do-over. But a do-over is simply not possible, is it? The only thing we can do is a do-better. And that do-better absolutely must be in the highest good for all.